Good morning. My name is Steve Luckabaugh, and I'd like to welcome you to the Engaging and Linking Young MSM into Healthcare webinar. This webinar is brought to you by the LGBT Health Education Center in collaboration with the Partnerships for Care HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, or HIV-TAC. The Partnerships for Care project is a three-year multi-agency project funded by the Secretary's Minority AIDS Initiative Fund and the Affordable Care Act. The goals of this project are to, 1, expand provision of HIV testing, prevention, care, and treatment in health centers serving communities highly impacted by HIV. 2, build sustainable partnerships between health centers and their state health department. And 3, improve health outcomes among people living with HIV, especially among racial and ethnic minorities. The project is supported by the HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, HIV-TAC. Our speaker today will be Dwayne Stewart. Dwayne Stewart is an award-winning journalist, LGBTQ rights activist, and anti-bullying advocate. He is currently the Fenway Institute Community Engagement Coordinator at Fenway Health in Boston, Massachusetts. Prior to Fenway, he was the inaugural LGBTQ health advocate for the City of Columbus Public Health Department, where he created and implemented the city's groundbreaking LGBTQ health initiative. Dwayne is also the founder and director of the Make It Better Foundation, a bullying prevention organization focused on building communities of inclusion in small towns nationwide. In 2010, he was published in the New York Times bestseller, It Gets Better, Coming Out, Overcoming Bullying and Creating a Life Worth Living, edited by Dan Savage and Terry Miller, and contributed to the anthology, Students, Teachers, and Leaders Addressing Bullying in Schools, a collegiate textbook published in partnership with Kent State University and the New Mexico State University in 2015. Dwayne is a former columnist at Outlook Ohio, the state's leading LGBTQ news magazine, where he founded The Other Side, a monthly column focused on the intersections of race and sexuality. He is also the founding co-host of Queer Minded, a top-rated LGBT news entertainment talk show on TalkTainmentRadio.com. Dwayne previously served on the board of directors with Kaleidoscope Youth Center, a safe drop-in center for LGBTQ youth in Central Ohio, and is a founder and former executive committee chair of Columbus Urban Pride, an organization committed to the advancement of LGBTQ people of color in Ohio. Dwayne received his Bachelor's of Science in Journalism from Ohio University, and you can visit DwayneStewart.com for more information. Please join me in welcoming Dwayne Stewart.
All righty. Thank you so much, Steve, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you, Adriana, and all the folks involved in putting this webinar together. I'm very honored to be here speaking with you all today. So really quick, just really quick housekeeping or disclosure statement, I guess you could say. This presentation is just for continuing education. I do not have any relevant relationships that are a conflict of interest. So quickly, wanting to go through the objectives for today, we're going to be really focusing on how to kind of some best practices when it comes to linking and engaging young men who have sex with men into healthcare. So we're going to start with summarizing the state of healthcare among young MSM and in the United States. We're going to describe the intersections of race, stigma, and health equity and its importance as it relates to community engagement and linkage to care. And we're going to discuss some important and cultural competency points and identify best practices for linking, engaging, and retaining young MSM into healthcare. And lastly, we're going to describe evidence-based examples for successful community engagement and linkage to care within young men who have sex with men populations. So please, like Adriana was saying, please interact with us today. We really want to answer all of your questions and let this webinar best serve you and your roles. So really quickly, I want to start with kind of just talking about some terms, like what terms are we going to be using? Terms are kind of very important in the LGBTQ community, and we're going to kind of go over what some of that language means just to start everyone at a basic kind of level of understanding. I don't want to assume that anyone knows what certain terms mean, and so we want to all start kind of on the same page when it comes to identifying and defining some of these terms. So there are many terms. The terms that we're going to talk about, they change over time, and it's important to have a working knowledge of the most commonly used terms as you are likely to encounter them if you are actively engaging with young MSM communities. Understanding and using certain terms can be very affirming for the client and patients that you work with, and it shows the understanding of the, showing the understanding of these terms in clinical settings is also, you know, a very quick and easy way to build client and patient trust. So really quickly, the terms on your screen, the terms on the left-hand side are kind of the general phrasing we see when it comes to LGBTQ communities. So most people are familiar with the LGB and T, and then there's a few other terms that have been added to that acronym over the years, Q, I, and A. And so just really want to quickly go over them really quickly. So as many of us know, lesbian means women who are sexually and are romantically attracted to women. Gay typically refers to someone who is a man who is sexually or romantically attracted to men. Bisexual typically refers to someone who has sexual or romantic attraction and relationships to both men and women. And transgender refers to someone whose gender identity does not align with the sex they were born with. Queer is more of a counterculture term, mostly used by youth that encompasses all genders and sexualities. Questioning, a term typically used in behavioral health settings that represents someone who is going through kind of a coming out or discovery process regarding their sexual orientation or gender identity. And there's a term, intersex, that some may or may not have seen. Most, I think, may have seen this in the medical field. But it's a term that refers to someone who was born with both male and female genitalia or a combination thereof. Some of you may have heard the outdated term, hermaphrodite. This is no longer an acceptable term and it's considered offensive. Intersex is becoming somewhat outdated as well, that term, as many clinicians are actually kind of moving away from intersex and kind of moving towards the phrase differences of sex development, or DSD. And asexual refers to someone who does not have sexual or romantic attraction, and typically, and is an ally as someone who is openly affirming for LGBT communities. So those are kind of the general terms we typically hear or encounter when it comes to LGBTQIA communities. So the terms on the right are kind of more important to the discussion that we're having today. I just want to make sure that we're all, again, on the same page. So MSM, as in the title, refers to a man who has sex with men. This is more of a clinical term that most men don't necessarily identify with. We typically use this within clinical settings. You know, I don't think I've ever heard a gay man identify themselves as MSM or say when they introduce themselves, I'm an MSM. That doesn't typically happen. So just it's important to understand that as we're having this conversation today. Bisexual, we talked about that before, but it's a man who has sex with both men and women in this context. And it's a crucial group that we kind of often leave out of research and outreach. And it's important that we name that group and make sure that we're always including them when we're talking about outreach to MSM population. The term gay, I want to get a little more specifically into this term. Like we mentioned earlier, it's men who have sexual and romantic relationships with men, but it's a broad term with many definitions. So gay, there are many women who use the term gay. There are men, you know, some transgender people consider themselves a part of the gay community. The term the gay liberation movement has often been used in past to talk about gay rights. You know, we use the term in the gay rights conversation, gay marriage. So the term gay is more a broader term, and it can mean something different to different people. Now, there's also, this term is not on your slide, but I think it's important to discuss. There's a term called same-gender loving that is commonly used among African-American MSM communities, and it's an alternative term to the term gay. That is, as many see the term gay as a loaded term that is mostly associated with kind of Caucasian communities. A lot of African-American MSM don't identify with that term. A lot of African-American MSM use same-gender loving instead. There's also an important term, an important group of men that we should also make sure we're discussing today that we, in the clinical kind of realm or outreach and engagement realm, refer to as heterosexual MSM. And these are men who may be married to women or otherwise consider themselves heterosexual, but they do also maybe sometime or another have sex with men. This is also a clinical term that most men do not identify with who may fit in this category. And this is a group that is also generally ignored by researchers and outreach workers. And it's usually connected to a term in the community called, on the down low. But that is a colloquial phrase that many associate with the African-American communities. And the phrase, many consider that phrase to be offensive, and much of the conjectures about men who this term is placed upon are false. For instance, there is no research that proves the down low just exists in African-American communities or that it is the sole cause of the increase of HIV infection among African-American women. That's something that has been in the news in the past. And then lastly, I want to briefly mention on this slide the term transgender, or talk about transgender male to female. We often kind of in the past have lumped transgender women into the MSM category, and this is something that we, fully in the present, many organizations have been moving away from this, and that's actually the best practice. Historically, you know, HRE research and services field have kind of incorrectly put these two groups together. Trans women are not men who have sex with men, and MSM outreach and engagement strategies should not include trans women. Distinctly separating strategic outreach plans are needed for both communities for successful community engagement. All right, so we should all be on the same page with these terms. If you have any questions about these terms, please make sure you ask during this presentation, but also I just want to make sure that everyone knows that if you do go to the website of the National LGBT Health Education Center, you can also find webinars about many of these different groups if you want to look at those webinars on your own time. So I want to also talk about, quickly, sexual orientation. And it can be useful to think about sexual orientation as being composed of kind of three dimensions: identity, behavior, and attraction or desire. For most people, identity and behavior and attraction desire do align. For example, a woman who is attracted to a man may have sexual relationships with men and identifies as straight. However, sometimes these dimensions do not align, so always align. So for example, a man who identifies as straight is married to a woman but feels a strong attraction to men. So I think it's very important as we have this discussion that we separate sexual orientation from gender identity and sexual behavior. A lot of times and we'll talk about this more, but when we talk about risk behavior, we often kind of lump groups together or put a risk factor on one community, but really it's not about the community and how they identify, it's about the behavior, the sexual behavior they're engaging in. So it's important that we have that discussion. So really quickly, sexual orientation refers to one's pattern of physical and emotional attraction to others, and while traditionally one sexual orientation has been described as homosexual or heterosexual, newer terminology like questioning queer or bisexual may more accurately reflect labels adolescents are comfortable with. Sexual behavior refers to the way one chooses to express one's sexual feelings. Sexual behavior often does not correlate with sexual orientation, like I was mentioning earlier, especially among adolescents. In other words, heterosexually identified, I apologize, youth may have some gender sexual experiences, and homosexual identified youth may have opposite gender sexual experiences. So it's just really important with this slide just to understand, to not make assumptions about just because someone identifies a certain way about their sexual behavior. So we're going to, again, like I mentioned, go into talking about some of the specific health disparities that men who have sex with men typically face. And in order to really guide our conversation today and kind of talk about, you know, when we get into later the best practices for engagement and linkage, we will kind of refer back to these disparities kind of are the reasons why we are engaging in these ways. And it's important for us to know what this population is facing. So this quote, LGBTQ youth who experience family and caregiver rejection are most at risk for serious health problems in adulthood. That came from a Child Welfare League of America recommended practices. The Child Welfare League put this amazing report together that talked about the issues, especially among LGBTQ youth. And we're going to get more into this later, but when it comes to young MSM, you're going to be working with this population in more intentional ways, they may be experiencing a lot of oppression in their lives, and some of that oppression may be occurring daily in the home as well, and you know, simply just for being who they are. And this is, you know, at a baseline level. So when you pile on top of that the regular struggles of a youth population that typically experiences issues in an adolescent, this exacerbates their potential for health risk. So you're seeing a polling question on your screens that we want to just quickly have you answer to kind of get a sense of just some of what the group kind of understands and knows about what this population. So the question is, which of the following health disparities have not been found among young MSM? So quickly take a moment and fill in your answer. The answer is A, HIV, B, substance use, C, respiratory illness, D, homelessness, and E, suicide risk. So which of the following health disparities have not been found among young MSM? And we're going to, in a moment, get into kind of the details of each of these. And again, wanting to what you guys know or think or understand or kind of just get the understanding of who's on the call around this issue. And we're going to, like I mentioned, we're going to go get very detailed into health disparities of the MSM population and kind of what exactly is going on. All right. So, most people got it right. It is C, respiratory illness. So There is no significant research findings right now regarding respiratory illness and MSM, but HIV, substance use, homelessness, and suicide risk are all, you know, health disparities within this population that we're going to get into. So I think many may already be aware of this. You know, this is a slide kind of just putting some information from the CDC. New HIV infections among MSM rose 12% between 2009-2013, and it's kind of been on a constant rise, really, since then. And we often in healthcare or in the field of HIV or people who work with Ryan White, the Ryan White program, we talk about this as the reason why we do this work for specifically within LGBT community, because MSM still make up 60% of new infections. And HIV among MSM is still, you know, is still a problem and it's still an epidemic that we need to be discussing. Also wanted to make sure that we are talking about the disparities when it comes to race as well. There's a very important report that came out back in 2012 called Back of the Line, The State of AIDS Among Black Gay Men in America. If you have not seen this report, I definitely recommend that you find it online. It's available and look through it. There was around this time, really, that we kind of were starting to talk about MSM of color and how they're very much being disproportionately affected. And they're one of the very stark numbers that came out of this report is by the time a black gay man reaches age 20, he stands a roughly 1 in 8 chance of being affected with HIV. And by age 40, the odds reach an astonishing 60%. So many in the black gay community kind of really mobilized around this and started doing a lot of great work to decrease the infection amongst African-American MSM. You know, African-Americans still make up more than half of people living with HIV, and still today, you know, MSM of color are disproportionately affected. So it's important that we're going to get more into how race plays a factor in health disparities and why that's important to this conversation. Now, many of you have seen the HIV continuum of care and are very familiar with it. I wanted to, within this conversation of health disparities when it comes to HIV, quickly discuss the continuum of care as it relates to youth specifically. So when we talk about youth, the treatment cascade is very different. The numbers look very different. And when you add being a man who has sex with men to this as well, the numbers can be very stark. As of March 25th, 2015, these are numbers from the CDC, the U.S. total population was 309 million people. Black African Americans make about 12.6% of that population, but like I mentioned before, make up about almost half, 44%, of new infections among adults and adolescents. And in 2010, African American gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men represented an estimated 72% of new infections among all African American men and 30% of an estimated 29,800 new HIV infections among all the gay and bisexual men. More new infections occurred among young African American gay and bisexual men than any other subgroup of gay and bisexual men. And I think the link to the report that talks about this is in the slides. It's very important to understand that the cascade, and when we talk about the number of people who are infected, the number of youth who are infected versus the number of youth who are actually virally retaining care and virally suppressed, the numbers are so starkly different. Only 6% of youth who are infected with HIV are actually suppressed, and that's really insane and why we need to be focusing on young MSM of color when it comes to outreach and engagement with healthcare. So another health disparity we mentioned is suicide. As many of you know, suicide is the second leading cause of death among young people ages 10 to 24. But, you know, lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth are 4 times more likely, and questioning youth are 3 times more likely to attempt suicide as their straight peers. And we also, this presentation focuses on MSM, but when we're talking about transgender youth, those numbers sometimes triple. So and I won't go through the details of all of the statistics on this slide, but when you are MSM, and of color, the suicide rates can often skyrocket. So homelessness is also something that's definitely a problem with among young LGBT communities and especially young MSM. 40% of homeless youth served by agencies identify as LGBT. 43% of clients served by drop-in centers identify as LGBT. And in some major cities, 60% of homeless youth at populations identify as LGBT. So this is a huge disparity within our population. And also within homelessness, there were some interesting findings that was put out by the William Institute. I mean, just chart here just kind of shows kind of some of the main reasons why youth are homeless or at risk for being homeless. And much of it does have to do simply with their identity because they ran away for family rejection or sexual orientation, gender identity. They were forced out by parents. You know, these almost half say that they face this kind of rejection in their home. Alcohol and drug abuse also is a major health disparity among young MSM. You know, the lack of social acceptance that LGBT youth experience can lead to dangerous behavior. LGBT youth experience high rates of cigarette, alcohol, marijuana use, as well as other illicit drugs, including cocaine, meth, and injection drugs. Research done by the University of Pittsburgh found that LGBT youth are 190% more likely to resort to substance abuse, including an increase of 340% for bisexual youth and 400% of lesbian youth. So this is a major issue that we need to definitely think about as we're engaging with young MSM. And also just wanted to talk briefly about access to care. So many, and there's just two quick slides about this, there's been a lot of reports and surveys done around access to care when it comes to LGBT populations. And I just want to briefly touch base on the fact that these are some numbers from, I believe, Lambda Legal's report that kind of shows the numbers when it comes to LGBT people receiving questions like healthcare professionals, you know, refuse to touch me or use excessive precaution. And 35% of people living with HIV said that this happened to them. And 10% of LGBT folks and 15% of transgender, you know, healthcare professionals are physically rough or abusive. The fact that anyone is saying this is happening is a problem, but we're seeing that because of just a sheer fear of discrimination, LGBT people are not going to the doctor.
So, Dwayne, I'm going to interrupt you. We do have a question. I think it's related to the slide just prior to this, but I wanted to interrupt because I think it's a good question. The question is, do we know what percentage of young Black MSM acquired infection during incarceration?
That's actually a very good question, and not information that I have for the slides today, but that is definitely an issue. And there's a lot of, we could do a whole presentation on HIV and incarceration, and especially among African American men who are disproportionately targeted by police and incarcerated. And so there's a lot of compounding issues. And one is condoms are not allowed in prison. And there are many reasons for that. I know the main argument right now is, you know, they don't want to promote, you know, if there are condoms available, you know, promote sexual abuse within the prison system by having condoms available. But there's, you know, there's a fine line between how we protect and, you know, how we protect a community and also how, especially within prison, and how we give them the tools to kind of protect themselves. So that's a very good question. I don't have the exact numbers for you on that, but there's a lot of information out there, and I can definitely do some research and get back to you guys on that. But yes, it is a major issue. So also the Center for American Progress just wanted to quickly show this issue. Talk about the report was titled How to Close the LGBT Health Disparities Gap. And this specific section talked a lot about the issue when it comes to race. So this is within LGBT population, and it kind of breaks it down by race, heterosexual versus homosexual, or kind of heterosexual versus LGBT. The T is not included here in this graph. But it really shows that, you know, if you look at the blue line at the top, the percentage of adults delaying or seeking health care among African Americans, 21% for heterosexual, 29% for African American LGBT community. And within each racial population, LGBT communities are showing that they are not seeking health care, especially if you look at the Latino population, that's a very stark difference, 13 and 28%. So it's important for us to understand that when you're dealing with this community, you're already starting from a place where they may not trust wanting to come into a medical environment. We have another polling question for you. A lot of what we talked about were kind of the statistics and health disparities. And so now we're going to kind of go into how we do good community engagement, right, and how we do good community care. And so quickly, the polling question, if you guys could quickly answer this for us, so we can get a better sense of kind of where many of you are at your facility. How would you rate your organization's current linkage to care and community engagement efforts for young men who have sex with men? Would you say poor, fair, good, excellent, or don't feel like this question is applicable? So quickly put in your answers for that and let us know what you think about your organization and how you think you guys are currently doing with recruiting or with linking and engaging with young men who have sex with men. So take a moment, give us your answers, and we're going to see what you guys think of that. All right, I think the results are about to be pulled up. Okay, so most of you said C, good, which is great. And even some said excellent, which is also really good. So about 8% fair, 15% poor. So hopefully this webinar will be very helpful to many of you. But it looks like some of you are already starting off on a really great start. So hopefully this will just strengthen your programming. All right, so really briefly, just wanted to highlight that there are many, you know, reputable documents from organizations, from, you know, leading governmental organizations around implementing community engagement. And so we often, you know, community engagement often can sometimes be the first thing that's cut when it comes to budget cuts. And we talk about how, you know, community engagement should kind of be a part of the job. But it actually, to do intentional community engagement, it does take a lot of thought process, a lot of processing, a lot of strategic planning that goes into it. And so there are these three documents I definitely recommend that you check out after this presentation if you want to get more in-depth into kind of some specific guidelines around good community engagement. So what are some principles of good community engagement? So setting clear goals is very important. Community engagement must meet the needs of the population and or communities in the health center service area. And strengthening the community's role and capacity to actively participate in the healthcare services and our research process. So it's important to learn about the community, the economic conditions, political leadership, demographic trends, history overall, and you know, with regard to research. Or with regard to the work that you're doing, and prior experiences with engagement activities. So really fostering transparency is important, building partnerships and trust, provide and promote capacity building around strategically interacting with this community, and, you know, make sure you are maintaining a long-term commitment. The main complaint that I get from a lot of folks that I interact with is, you know, a certain organization, they were, you know, they needed to get so many MSM tested or into this program, and they worked with us a lot to do that, and then once the grant ended, they were gone. We never heard from them again. So, and then when you get another, maybe get another grant that focuses on this population, they remember that, and so you may have a much more difficult time of re-engaging with them. So continued and maintaining a long-term commitment is very, very important. So a bit about community involvement. So the community must inform your strategic planning. So scheduling regular community conversations. There's a style called Art of Hosting that I often use, and we're going to talk about that more at the end when I give some examples of community engagement. But really, really convening the community around, so for instance, if you're planning any type of engagement with young MSM, convening a large group, even if you can, 100 or so young folks who are MSM or who are allies to that community, I love to get everyone in the room who's a stakeholder. So from the young MSM themselves to their parents to their providers, getting, you know, a equal amount of these different groups into one room to discuss how they would like, you know, your community engagement to be and what actually they feel like is the best way to reach them is really a great way to start any type of community engagement that you're doing, because it gets immediate buy-in from the community, and you also immediately know what that community wants from you, and so you can immediately include that in your strategic planning. This can also be done through community advisory boards, so having maybe a subset, maybe 15 to 20 folks who meet regularly to comment on your strategic plan around your community engagement, and also building stakeholder relationships and continuing those relationships is very important. So the people who are the popular opinion leaders or people who are the kind of the community leaders among that population. So what are some consequences of poor community engagement? So it's important that we talk about what can happen when you don't do the necessary best practices when it comes to community engagement. And you can create some mistrust. The community is, like I was mentioning earlier, the community is likely to view your institution and you with mistrust. You know, like I mentioned, drive-by engagement, only engage in the community when you feel like you may need something. Tokenism can sometimes often happen when community members may feel that they were being used by your organization for the purposes of meeting its goals and that the voices and wishes of the community weren't truly respected or honored. And, you know, there can sometimes be duplication of efforts. If there's a lot of aid service organizations in an area, you know, when stakeholders don't communicate with each other, the risk of duplication of efforts increases. And in a time of diminishing resources, this is particularly problematic. So if there are organizations doing the same thing, somehow working together to mutually help one another. And you can also kind of create an echo chamber over time. So when organizations don't engage stakeholders effectively, they miss out on important input and run the risk of believing that their perspectives are best. You know, you may get some good points from your first meeting conversation and kind of use those within your organization, but it's good to continue to get the input of the community so you're not creating this kind of echo chamber within your organization. And poor recruitment and retention. It should go without saying that effective engagement can result in poor enrollment and programs. This is really important. You know, clinicians love data and evidence, but communities, they love stories. And good community engagement requires telling a compelling story. So when, you know, a lot, especially when we're talking about young folks, young MSM, they don't respond often to clinical jargon, just the simple fact that you need a certain number of people. They may not even respond to just the fact that you feel like this is going to be great for them or, you know, be good for their health, what the program you're trying to engage them in. And so, you know, we need to do better with telling a good, compelling story when it comes to our community engagement. How is this going to help the community in the long run? How is this going to help them in the short run? How is this going to help them immediately? So we're going to talk briefly about kind of health equity and cultural humility and how that's kind of important when you're engaging young MSM. So this is a quote that I love from Nelson Mandela. Poverty is not an accident, like slavery and apartheid. It is man-made and can be removed by the actions of human beings. And I love that because you can replace the word poverty with many ills in society. You can replace the word poverty with transphobia, with homophobia, with health inequity. And I do believe that none of these things are accidents. And, you know, with the work of our human beings and the actions, that these things can be removed from society.
So, yeah, I'm going to stop you again because there's another question that I'd like to bring up mid-talk here, and so I'm just going to go ahead and read it. So the question is, social media is the main mode of sexual connection, for example, Grindr or Tinder. How is Fenway using, or in your experience, you know, any other ways to use social media to increase engagement in healthcare or HIV services?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We actually, there's going to be a lot to talk about that in a moment, but that's very important. And so when you're talking about high-risk populations and you're talking about, especially with MSM, there are a lot of MSM, that's kind of with youth, especially today's society, that's the mode of a lot of youth are engaging and hooking up and, you know, meeting each other on these apps. And so there are many, so if you look into the different apps, so Grindr, and there's one called Scruff. They actually have departments and advertising directors who are very much aware that, you know, their app is used to connect people sexually, and so they understand the importance of them being responsible, socially responsible. And so we, in many cases, have partnered with Grindr. We partnered with, like, a group, an organization called Manhunt, Scruff, these many different apps, and partnered with their advertising department to promote advertising of maybe testing or if there's a research study happening that they can push out to all of their followers. And you can also geo-target to your area as well. So it's very effective and definitely something that should be used, it should be focused on when you're working with young MSM. And we're going to get into more examples of that in a moment. All right, so I want to briefly talk about cultural competency, to define cultural competency. We're not going to be on this slide for very long, but I think many of you know what that term means. And this is the specific definition from that the NIH uses. I mean, I want to just highlight that, you know, the concept of cultural competency does have a positive effect on patients. So when you are working with young MSM, it is very important that you understand their culture. It's very important that you also move to a place away from cultural competency and towards cultural humility. Because when you do that, the patient care delivery, has a positive effect on patient care delivery by enabling providers to deliver services that are respectful and responsive to the health beliefs, practices, and cultural and linguistic needs of a diverse population. So this definitely applies to young MSM. And so when we talk about health equity, that kind of should be the goal. So we understand that health inequity is systematic, it can be socially produced, and it is in many cases unfair. But when we get to a place of health equity, then we're kind of leveling the playing field and getting people the opportunity to engage in good healthcare. So, but we have to be intentional and understand, you know, when we talk about health equity, what are we talking about? So racial justice does not equal, you know, diversity. Diversity, really, the term diversity means variety. It means you have lots of different things, but lots of different people in a room. But all those people are not the same. And so it's important that when we're doing this work, we're doing it from a place of equity. And, you know, equality, the term equality, we use that all the time. That equals sameness, and the same thing may not work for everybody. And really, we want to be moving to a place of equity, something that's fair and just for everyone. And I love to use this slide because it kind of really visually shows kind of what we're talking about when we talk about health equity. Everyone's on the same level playing field. Many people have barriers in front of them. If you, you know, as you're seeing in this slide, not everyone can see the game well because of, you know, the different barriers that people face. But if we create a situation where everyone can watch the game, can be in the game, we create an equitable space. So really, let's talk about what some of the causes of health disparity. These are the core determinants of health, and for many of you, this is kind of the foundation of all health centers across the country. So I don't need to go too much detail into this, but it's important for us when we're talking about MSM to understand that there are many causes of health disparity, and most of it, a lot of it, we talk about housing as healthcare, talk about education and literacy and physical, their physical environments, what's going on at home. Many of the social determinants that we talk about of health can, if they're not in line or not doing well at home or doing well in other aspects, can definitely lead to poor health outcomes. Getting into linkage to care, the number one rule, and this is a quote from famous Patch Adams, the number one rule of successful linkage to care, and he says it really best, if you treat a disease, you win, you lose. You treat a person, I guarantee you, you'll win no matter what the outcome. But that's how we move to a place of cultural humility, when we're treating each individual person and the issues that they're facing. And so if you meet their needs, they'll meet yours. So when a young MSM walks into your office and they're dealing with maybe homelessness, they're sleeping on an aunt's couch because their mom kicked them out of the home, or they apparently recently lost their job, or they're unemployed, so they don't know where their next meal is coming from. So HIV or any health issue that you're talking about isn't going to make it on the top of that priority list for that young MSM. So it's important that you're addressing all the many issues that they're facing, or you're at least acknowledging the issues that they're facing in their life before you talk about the needs of what your organization is trying to do to engage them, if you for good community engagement or for them to want to continue to engage. And it really moves us towards a place of holistic health, to looking, that's a key need when it comes to working with young MSM. I'm looking at all of their emotional, intellectual, physical, social, environmental, financial, and spiritual needs, because when you affirm all of these different parts of their existence, they're much more likely to want to engage with your organization. And that moves us to a place of holistic engagement. So you're treating the whole person is very crucial. And sometimes family engagement is necessary. Like I mentioned earlier, a lot of youth who are MSM experience family rejection, and then maybe don't feel safe at home. And this increases their health risk. And so when you are addressing that issue, you are also addressing their health care. And also, I was mentioned earlier, housing is health care. If someone does not have a place to lay their head at night, or they're worried about where they're going to sleep that night, their health is the last thing on their mind. And this term intersectionality, many have heard it. I also wanted to make sure we discussed the issues related to the multiple marginalized identities. So we talked about earlier, a young African-American male is considered at much higher risk for many, for HIV, for suicide, for many of these other issues, because of their compounding marginalized identities. And so the interconnected nature of social categorizations, like as race, class, and gender, as they apply to a given individual or group, regarded as creating a overlapping and interdependent system of discrimination and disadvantage. And that's from the Oxford English Dictionary. But that we have to be including or thinking about intersectionality when we are doing community engagement, especially within when it comes to race, when it comes to intersections of race and sexuality and gender. Going into more kind of details of how you do community engagement, a good community engagement with young MSM. Strategic preparation is really key. You have to have a strategic plan. You can't just, decide one night to go to a gay bar and engage the community. There needs to be a lot of planning involved. There needs to be a lot of training of staff. So when they come into your office, from the front desk to the CEO, they feel respected and they feel accepted. Because if they're at any point during that process that they don't feel accepted, they're not coming back. And so best practice is having awesome, what we call at Fenway, awesome, relatable providers. So clients look for providers who look like them, talk like them, and someone they can trust, eradicating what we call the white coat syndrome. So when a young MSM walks into your door, there's automatic understanding. If you see somebody in a white coat, that means that they're a doctor and they're above you and they're not going to understand you. So having even clinicians, they can be awesome, relatable providers and can connect with youth if you do it strategically. Now, you also finding out where they are is important. So doing, in your area, doing needs assessments of where a young MSM congregate, where they're located, and then you have to go there. They're not, young MSM are not going to come to you. They are, like I said, they're dealing with so many, like we discussed in the beginning of this presentation, so many compounding issues, possibly discrimination, possibly homelessness, suicide ideology, lots of different things might be going on. So they more than likely will not go through everything they need to do to get to you. So if you go to them and you're providing services in their community, they're much more likely to engage. Creating youth and MSM-friendly spaces is very important, like I mentioned, from the front door to the CEO, needing to make sure that all spaces in your organization are accepting. Community inclusion from the planning to implementation. So like I mentioned earlier, having those community conversations is very important. or even if you are not able to convene, you know, 100 folks that are MSM or allies of young MSM, having smaller community advisory boards or having smaller community conversations, making sure you're doing needs assessment, getting thoughts from the community that you are including in your strategic outreach and engagement plan. And again, this goes back to, you know, doing strategic community engagement. So these are some things when a youth walks in your door, they instantly ask themselves some of these questions. And this is actually from a report that many youth said these things. Oh, my God, is everyone here positive? They're thinking about, you know, even when you walk into a place like Fenway Health, we are a lot of times in the community known as the place we actually in New England have the most patients who are HIV positive. And so there's that stigma still there. You know, I think that my cousin's baby's father, little sister's at the front desk. So them thinking that they may know somebody there and not wanting that to happen. You know, will everyone know that I'm gay if I come in here? What will they think of me? This is way too much. So this quote is very important. And, you know, in multicultural society like ours, the issue of belonging is especially important. One of the first issues of an adolescent walking through the door or even thinking about trying a community program is whether he or she can belong to this group of people. So making a space where they feel like they belong is crucial to retaining, linking, and engaging with young MSMs. So how do you, again, do this well? So you need to create unprecedented community partnerships. So, you know, like I said, they're not going to just automatically come to you if you put a flyer in a gay bar. So you need to be really engaging with LGBTQ youth groups in your area, partnering with organizations that serve homeless youth. You know, even sex workers, working with sex workers or human trafficking advocacy groups, you know, working with LGBT fraternities, open and affirming churches. And I'm also the ballroom community. For many of you who don't know what the ballroom community, just Google Paris is Burning and you'll learn everything you need to know. But the ballroom community is an underground, not really underground anymore. It's more, if you've seen, of course, all of you may have heard of Madonna's Vogue. She got that from the ballroom community. But many African-American MSM and trans folks, trans women specifically, come together and they have what they call dance-off or compete to do dancing and fashion shows, and this happens on a regular basis. It's a very large ballroom community. The ballroom community is very involved in HIV education and outreach. So if there's a ballroom community in your area, that's a great way to connect with the community. And again, when you're connecting with these different groups, it's important that you are sustaining that relationship and maintaining that relationship with or without the deliverables that you may have from your provider or from your agency. So it's also very important to have community-tailored marketing strategies. Like we talked about before, they need to know that they belong, right, if they're going to engage and stay engaged. So these are some examples of some community-tailored marketing strategies. Like I said, they need to see their face in your advertising. The testing makes us stronger. That was I'm sure many of you have heard that from that phrase possibly from the CDC, with the CDC program, specifically geared towards MSM, African-American MSM, because of the high infection rates. And this was created by and for African-American MSM, this program. And if you look up Testing Makes Us Stronger, you can see the many iterations of this flyer. Also, this is, again, another example. So these are just examples of really good flyers that include MSM and cater to MSM. And like I said, they need to see their faces in what you're doing. So what does successful community engagement look like for young MSM? So these are some programs that I've been involved with and that have done this well. There's a group here in Boston called C2P Boston. This is a part of the National Adolescent Trials Network. That's where the funding comes from. But the Smile Linkage to Care program, while the main focus of the program also has, you know, like I mentioned, has a research component with the Adolescent Trials Network, the study seeks to utilize the existing Connect to Protect coalition infrastructure to address structural barriers that hinder the ability of HIV-infected youth to link to care and remain engaged in care. Through the work of SMILE and C2P, coalitions have added a focus of identifying and achieving structural change to improve linkage to care, engagement in care, and retention in care outcomes for HIV-infected youth. So if you have not heard of Connect to Protect, it is a national, there's many different Connect to Protects around the country. It's a perfect model for how you address many of the structural barriers that MSM face so that they can. So when you remove those barriers, they have better chances of connecting and being retained into care. So I definitely recommend you check that out, look them up. Empowerment is also a program that I was involved in. Empowerment was a specific intervention from the CDC that basically created testing centers, community testing centers around the country specifically for MSM of color. I ran one of these testing centers in Ohio. And when you, and that, it goes back to that holistic engagement. When you create a space that is for, made for and by young MSM, they are more likely to kind of flock to that space. And you also, in that space, in these empowerment spaces, there are behavioral health specialists. There are regular nightly events, social events. There are regular support group meetings. You're addressing, but also as a part of that component, there's HIV testing also happening on this at the same time. And so you are connecting HIV testing. You're normalizing HIV testing. You're normalizing sex positivity while they're engaging in normal everyday activity that they relate to. And that the center in Ohio was called the Greater Columbus Empowerment Center that I helped, that I ran. Also in Ohio, I helped create what's called the Greater Columbus LGBTQ Health Coalition. So this was a group of people who met on a regular basis. They were a part of all the different LGBT and health organizations in the city, coming together every week to talk about, much like C2P, what can we do to remove structural barriers at an institutional level. So you need outreach workers on the ground, you know, out in the community doing the work. But you also need folks who are in the background strategically thinking about how we remove structural barriers institutionally. And then the Young Black Gay Men's Leadership Initiative is a program that really does a national conference every year that brings young Black MSM leaders together to kind of talk about how they can be leaders in their community. So it's a really great leadership development program and really empowering young black gay men to kind of take control and also become leaders in their community. And we can, you know, like I said, when MSM see their faces, they're more likely to engage. And it's important that we create a space, because a lot of young MSM face structural barriers where they may not be in a position to acquire leadership skills. And so this creates a space specifically for that, so that we are building leaders who look like the community.
There's one question before we get to the next slide. The question is, based on your experiences besides gay bars, where are some other locations to reach out to the MSM community?
Yeah, and we can go back. There was a slide for unprecedented partnerships. So really looking into some of these things in your area. So it's in thinking more specifically, besides gay bars, you know, if there is an LGBT center in your area that may host a coming out group, a support group, or if there's lots of LGBT sports leagues. There's a gay rugby group back home in Ohio where I live. There's an international LGBT softball and organization. So looking at partnering with, you know, maybe sponsoring some of their events may be a great way to do that. Also, like I mentioned, looking into if there is a human trafficking or sex worker advocacy organization in your area. You know, a lot of young MSM who have been kicked out of their homes, unfortunately, do sometimes turn to sex work or survival sex. And there's, you know, a lot of the colleges in America now have LGBT fraternities. So there are gay male fraternities, and you can partner with them to do some outreach. So I hope that answers your question, but there are lots of different ways, lots of different places where you can engage young MSM. And I can't stress enough to connect with the bar community in your area. That is already a group of folks of color who are MSM, mostly identified, that are willing and wanting to kind of work with AIDS service organizations and other organizations who do HIV-related work. We're going to attempt to show a video and this is an example of the National Minority AIDS Council created a video about interviewing some young Black gay men about PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. I think many of you may be familiar with that. If you're not, you can email the LGBT Health Education Center. There's lots of tutorials, lots of webinars on PrEP. We could take up 3 hours talking about PrEP. But this is an example of a video that is inclusive. That, you know, when you see the faces of when the community sees their face, they are much more likely to engage. I can't drive that home enough. So we're going to try to show this video.
Encourage them to have a conversation about PrEP and explore it as an option for them. I do think that for Black gay men, this can radically change how HIV affects our community?
I would probably actually talk mostly to my Black gay friends, just to let them know like what the experience is like, because I'm sure a lot of people are very curious. There aren't a lot of people who I know that are on it, but everyone wants to know what it's like, what's like the side effects, like, you know, could you see yourself doing this for the rest of your life? So I would definitely tell people, because I want everyone else to know, because I feel like there's a lack of knowledge around like what's going on with PrEP.
I have met more Black gay men who are HIV positive than are negative. So there's a strong likelihood that I may in fact be in a relationship, a long-term loving relationship or something short-term with somebody who is HIV positive. And for that reason, I felt like it was necessary to take that extra level of protection.
I feel like for Black gay men, PrEP could be difficult in terms of like this drug adherence. Like, I don't know if I see that completely working out just because of our strained relationship with like healthcare and medications and things like that. But I feel like in a number of ways, there are a lot of Black gay men who need PrEP, who PrEP is the perfect option, who condoms do not work for, who all this other messaging around HIV just does not work for. And I feel like I'm in that group as well.
So that was really a really great example of how a health organization went out into the community, interviewed folks, and talked about the realities of what PrEP in Black gay male communities looked like and felt like and what it was like. And so this might be a great example of a video you might show at the beginning of a community conversation or at the beginning of a community advisory board meeting to kind of start conversation around a certain health issue, this one being PrEP access. Other examples of kind of what successful community engagement with young MSM looks like, and these are examples that from my personal professional experience. So in Ohio, where I was, like I mentioned in the bio, was where I was the LGBT health advocate for the city of Columbus, we did several community conversations when we began this initiative. So we started the initiative with several community conversations. This is just one of them. And in Ohio, in the Midwest, it's a little different. I'm not sure where everyone's from on the call, but this was kind of the first time in Ohio we were even broaching the subject of LGBT healthcare, and the city was actually paying the initiative to happen. It's actually putting money into decreasing health disparity within LGBT populations. And so we had a great turnout simply because this was something that was really being talked about. And so we held several of these events. Improving LGBT healthcare was the first one. We did improving transgender healthcare. We did improving lesbian healthcare. We just went through the letters. Each community, we went out into the community. We partnered, as you see at the bottom of this, the logos with the community, Columbus Public Health, and then the local LGBT center with Stonewall Columbus. That's their logo. We did that with each organization, with each event, improving transgender healthcare. We partnered with the Trans Ohio, which is the Ohio Trans Advocacy Group. So each event had a community partner that was in that community, and we did a structure. We had a speaker at the top of the event. And we did a structured community conversation, and we were using the art of hosting style, which I mentioned before, where we at the end of the event created a community action plan that was created by that community, by those folks in the room, that we then used to help build the LGBTQ health initiative. So whenever we went out in the community, we could always say this was built by the community, and that definitely helps with buy-in along the way. What's known as Obamacare, but the Affordable Care Act, we hosted several LGBT-specific health insurance enrollment events with Enroll America. And, you know, there's also lots of statistics about health insurance within LGBT communities that we didn't talk about today, and it's much lower than the national average, especially within transgender communities. So we did specific events that were geared towards and for LGBT communities when it came to health insurance enrollment. There is, in Boston here, a very big and important event called Coming Out and Keeping the Faith that happens every year. And this, I think, is going to be the third or fourth year it's happening. The Fenway Institute here puts on this event, and it's really about connecting faith leaders with young LGBT population. And so, and that's important because, and we didn't talk about this in great detail, but a lot of family rejection comes from, and there's a lot of faith-based rejection that happens within LGBT communities. And especially when we're talking about African-American MSM, many face the rejections from their church, their what they consider their church families, and that can be very devastating. And so this event specifically breaks down that stigma that religious leaders do not care about young MSM. And so and at this event, there are health information disseminated. There's information about the different healthcare services that happen at Fenway and across the city of Boston. But it creates a really great moment where you're addressing a very specific structural barrier, and it's connecting that to someone's healthcare. And then more recently, we did a screening of the film called Blackbird, which is a film by Patrick Ian Polk about a young black gay man and his experiences growing up in rural Mississippi. And there are some HIV themes that are part of this film. So what we did, the film was heading to DVD, and so we partnered with the distributors of the film to do a special screening right before the film was released to kind of promote the release of the DVD, but also to create a moment of community discussion around what were the missing needs in Boston when it came to LGBT communities of color specifically. And this event had over 150 people that came out to it. I think most of the film was a draw. But if you can connect, again, healthcare to something that's popular, that's happening, that people care about, they will come out, and in the process, they will also receive important health information and are more likely to engage because you are investing in something that's important to them. All right, so we're going to do another quick video, another example of, you know, how to include the MSM in a marketing strategy, a marketing video. This is also about PrEP, but it's an animation, and I thought it actually comes from a group in Nigeria, and it's actually a really great example of how to be culturally competent in your outreach and marketing.
You know, I get I'm supposed to use a condom every time, but that's so not my reality. Sometimes I'm kicking it and it feels so good and I just want to go with the moment. Sometimes the guy is just so hot.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just feel alone or I want to connect and finally get real with somebody. It might not make sense, but I really do want to protect myself. It's just that the next day, all I can think about is HIV. I hate that, you know? I want to live my life, but for real, I do not want to get HIV. And that's why, when I learned about PrEP, I was like, there's something besides a condom I can use to prevent getting HIV? I was all telling my doctor, I want that. She said PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's like, you know those pills people take when they travel to another country so they don't get malaria? It works so long as you take it, but it stops working when you don't. My doctor says nothing can protect you perfectly, but taking PrEP can reduce your risk. And here's the serious part. If you take it and try to use condoms and get tested and be smart about using all your prevention strategies. So, I wanted to try it. She said taking PrEP is a big decision because it means you have to see your doctor every few months. I was like, I can work with that. She gave me a lot of information. She told me about how it works and about the side effects that some people may have, and steps I can take to make sure that PrEP protects me as much as possible. I know PrEP is not a magic pill that just makes HIV go away, but it's one more thing that I can do to improve my chances of never getting HIV. I can just relax and live my life.
For more information about taking PrEP, talk to your doctor or go to this website.
So that's just a really great example of kind of the hearing from the voice of the community in an advertising campaign and gearing a specific advertising campaign when it comes to healthcare towards a specific community and doing it in a way that's culturally competent, that's affirming of that population as well. In these videos, PrEP was the focus, and that was somewhat intentional for this conversation. I know at many health centers, around the country, PrEP and MSM are kind of the big topics right now, right? We're talking about how can we better engage and make sure people like MSM understand that PrEP exists and that it's the option. And, you know, PrEP is, the, you know, kind of the big next step for HIV research and HIV prevention and engagement. And so this is a really hot topic. And so I know I wanted to take a moment to talk about specific community engagement when it comes to PrEP. And so there have been, we've done several events here at Fenway Institute in a partnership with AIDS Action Committee and the Multicultural AIDS Coalition to specifically talk about PrEP. And so there's been two. We're currently in the middle of what we're calling a PrEP education series. And so this is a series of community conversations that are geared towards the conversations around PrEP, but specifically within LGBT communities of color, especially MSM of color. Because as we're seeing, MSM of color are kind of the highest hit population when it comes to HIV, but they're also the population in our needs assessment that have shown here locally who know least about the option of PrEP. And so intentionally kind of creating engagement events and programming around PrEP is important. So what can you do right now today to kind of better increase your, kind of to include best practices in what you're doing when it comes to engaging young MSM? So you can send staff to conferences around, you know, actually put funds into sending staff to trainings, specific conferences and trainings around LGBT communities. These are some great conferences listed here, Creating Change, Philadelphia Transgender Health Conference. We just actually here at Fenway had our first transgender health conference just this past weekend. It was very well attended. And there's also the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, their annual conference. You know, you could right now go to the store, go online, order these magazines, and have culturally commented magazines and posters in your waiting room. As soon as somebody walks in and they see this magazine called Swerve, which is very well known amongst Black gay communities, they're like, oh, wow, they know about Swerve. They must really affirm who I am and know who I know. And that's a really simple thing you can do to create trust right at the beginning when they walk in the door. And there's some other magazines listed there. You can, like we talked about earlier, sponsor local LGBT events from, you know, the drag shows, events for the ballroom community, did the LGBT sports events. You know, there's lots of different events that LGBT, you know, partner with your local pride event, the local LGBT community center. You know, actually showing openly, well, one, coming out as an ally is another thing we can talk about for hours. But when you do things like that, you come out to the community as an ally, and that's very important. And, you know, hire healthcare navigators. One thing when it comes to engaging and retaining, linking and retaining MSM into care is, you know, all the red tape. You know, especially when we're dealing with young folks, they're not used to going to the doctor. They have HIV. They have never been to the doctor before in their lives. They don't know how to navigate insurance and healthcare. So having specific, awesome, relatable healthcare navigators and to help them kind of cut through that red tape is very important. So lastly, I just want to conclude with a quote from Arthur Ashe, that I love, and it's very applicable to any type of community engagement. If you want to do it well, you have to start where they are, you have to use what you have, and you do what you can. If you start at those basic levels, you'll be successful. Start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can. That's really the basics of community engagement. So thank you guys all so much. So there are some other resources attached to this slide. If you guys have any other questions, please make sure you send it, you know, shoot a message, and Adriana will read it for you. But like I mentioned, there are lots of other resources. The National LGBTQ Health Education Center has many resources specifically about youth. Those are included in this slide set. Other national resources for youth are also available. The Trevor Project Lifeline, I use that almost every day whenever I'm talking to LGBT youth. If they are in, especially if they're in a rural community where they don't have anyone to talk to, calling the Trevor Project line is a great way to have somebody just talk to that will affirm who you are. You know, there's lots of resources for families. We'll talk about that. Make sure you check those out. And there's lots of resources for community engagement. So these are a lot of the reports that I mentioned throughout the presentation today. So you have those and you can check those out at your leisure. And these are also some resources on the health disparities that we discussed. So make sure you can check those out in these slides that. All right. Thank you guys all so much. If you guys have any questions, I will try to have some answers. So thank you all. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Dwayne. So we do have time right now for Q&A, about 10 minutes. And as we're waiting for some questions to come in, I do want to remind participants that the slides are available for download as soon as you leave today's session. So when you close the WebEx software, page will pop up and you'll be able to download the slides. You'll have access to all those great resources that Dwayne was talking about, as well as both of those videos that we included links to those videos. So you'll be able to view those again, or share them, or use them however you would like to. So again, to type a question in, or to send us a question, type it into either the chat or the Q&A box and hit send and make sure it comes to me, the webinar host, so that I can read it aloud. And while we're waiting for a question, I do want to, there was a comment that I missed earlier in the presentation from a participant. It's not a question, but I think it's worth just kind of putting it out there to all the participants, and to you, Duane, that same-gender loving is not just used by African-Americans, of course, that other communities may use it, but I think that Duane was kind of highlighting that, you know, with the populations that he works with, it's a commonly used term.
Yeah, definitely. And, I did not mean to imply that it's just used with African-American. It's just in my personal experience, that's where I've seen it used the most. And also for that reason, because the term, they don't really identify with the term gay. So, but yes, it's used, I agree, and thank you for that comment. It's definitely used across many different populations and identities.
We don't have any questions yet, but I don't want to cut anybody off. So again, to remind folks, just type in your questions here. It's the chat or into the Q&A box and hit send. And also as a reminder, as we're waiting for some questions, the webinar is available for CME credit. And in order to get your CME credit, all you have to do is fill out an evaluation, and that's on that page that pops up automatically as well with the slides. So the page will pop up, and we really appreciate everybody's feedback on the evaluation, even if you're not interested in CME credits. And once you fill out the evaluation, you'll be able to download your certificate of completion to prove that you came to today's webinar. So here we are. The question is, what has been successfully used to advocate on behalf of transgender people during incarceration and reentry? Do you have any resource suggestions?
That's a very good question. So there is an organization called Black and Pink that is national. There's one in Boston. I know they were just starting a group in Ohio when I left. And yes, because, you know, and there's a documentary by, oh dear, now her name is escaping me, Laverne Cox. Oh, that's horrible that I forgot that. called Freeing Cece, about a young lady named Cece McDonald. So there's a lot of activism, a lot of work happening around that. It's unfortunately a very controversial issue, although it doesn't seem like it should be. You know, if someone identifies as LGBT, they should be able to be placed in a safe environment in prison. And a lot of times, when we talk about this issue, the main issue is the safety of the individual being placed where they should be placed. And so, yeah, there's a lot going on. I don't know, I'm sorry, I know the question was statistics. I don't have any specific statistics about that right now, but again, that's something I can send out to the group. But there are groups out there that are working on this, and there is information that can be accessed. I would start with Black and Pink. They actually work with LGBT groups in prisons and have a lot of those statistics. And there are some other activism efforts, like a documentary that's being produced by Laverne Cox called Freeing Cece.
Thank you. We still do have a few more minutes, so I want to hang on the line here and make sure we have another question. So going back to the use of mobile apps, have you heard of any outreach workers creating profiles to use as a form of outreach to educate and encourage positive individuals to reach out for help? And if so, were those efforts successful?
Yes, actually, and I mentioned the empowerment program that I helped run in Columbus before. That's something we did on a regular basis. But it really depends on the app policies, because there are some apps who do not like that happening on their app, and so you really have to do that kind of the upfront strategic engagement and talking with the advertising directors or the kind of folks who are running the app, reaching out to those groups and kind of seeing what you are allowed to do. For instance, we use Adam for Adam, which is an app, or it's online. It's called Adam for Adam. I think the app is called Radar. But we had a profile that was some members of our outreach workers had profiles, and they just, on their profile, they explicitly stated they were a health outreach worker. If you have any questions about HIV, please let me know. And we often, every day at least, we were getting some kind of response or question from members, and it was all anonymous. It's a great thing because, you know, like our funders, they like us to track stuff, so you can easily kind of print off those interactions without, you know, of course, using their names or their screen name to show that work was done and show what you're actually educating on. We also did the same thing with Grindr, but again, make sure that you check with the policies of these different apps, because again, it's different for each group. Some, like Scruff, they actually have free advertising that they offer to community health centers instead of doing the kind of outreach of having someone have a profile.
Awesome. Thank you, Duane. And thanks for the question. And again, so we'll hang out here and see if any other questions kind of trickle in now towards the end of our session. Again, want to thank everybody, including Duane, for your participation today. It's been really great to have everyone online. start off our Thursday mornings together. It looks like we don't have any more questions, so I will take the lack of questions in the chat and the Q&A as the end of our session. So thanks so much to everyone at the Partnerships for Care team for today's webinar, and to Duane Stewart for presenting, and to all of our participants for joining us. So when you close out of the webinar today, you'll be automatically directed to a page where you can download the slides and fill out an evaluation, and that will make you eligible for your CME credit. So thanks, everyone, again, and we'll see you at the next webinar.